Hello, Kristen.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
You had a nice holiday?
I sure did. I got to go up north, north of D.C. It's really cold, but I enjoyed it. Got a lot of turkey.
That's what Thanksgiving is about.
Being How about you?
I'm already in New England where it's cold. it was cold. There was good turkey. There was good pumpkin pie. I learned the best way to make pumpkin pie, ginger snap crust.
Ooh, that sounds really good.
I didn't make it myself, but I ate it, and it was delicious.
I feel like a sign of growing up was something that I experienced over Thanksgiving this year in a pretty serious way is the lack of desire to eat pumpkin pie right after the Thanksgiving meal. That always used to be, like, as soon as you were done with the turkey and stuffing, you wanted to move straight to the pumpkin pie, and this year I was just out. I was like, I don't even want to think about it.
That's very mature of you, very adult. So why don't you reintroduce yourself to the bloggingheads.tv crowd again?
Hi, everybody. I'm Kristen Soltis. I am a Republican pollster with the Winston Group, and I blog at kristensoltis.com, and I also occasionally write for pollster.com.
And I'm Bill Scher with Campaign for America's Future, blogging at ourfuture.org, also at liberaloasis.com, where I've been for ages, where I do the Liberal Oasis radio show podcast. I'll have a little special guest this week, David Reese of Get Your War On, who has a new set of Get Your War On strips, bring him out of retirement. But that aside, when this airs at bloggingheads.tv, it will be Friday afternoon, and the White House Deficit Commission will have cast its vote on the Simpson-Bowles plan. And as we speak, we don't know exactly how that vote is going to turn out, but the expectation is that it will not get the supermajority, 14 out of 18 commissioners, required to fast-track the proposal to Congress to be voted on this month. That was the informal agreement that the commission had with Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Harry Reid. But it could get a simple majority, maybe 10 or 11 votes. And if that's the case, I expect by now that Simpson and Bowles will be touting this as a major victory, even though it fell short of their own set of rules. This whole issue has got the liberal blogosphere, you know, quite aflame. When I've talked about this with some other conservative guest hosts, the right-wing blogosphere has kind of shrugged their shoulders at this whole process, thinking that it was all just spinning the wheels and nothing was going to come of it. Is that still the case on the right?
We've got now Senator Coburn, Senator Crapo. They've come out and said that they might be supportive of it. Bob Costa at National Review at the Corner said, you know, he asked, is Coburn worried about how anti-tax activists will respond to his support of the plan? Because one of the big hang-ups among conservatives, folks like Paul Ryan, is that in order to reduce the deficit, they're not just talking about cutting spending, they're talking about increasing taxes in some places. And Coburn's response to Costa was, our obligation is to the country at whole, not to special interest groups. Almost sort of a veiled stab at the sort of like Americans for Tax Reform, you know, the pledge where if you vote for anything that looks, smells, tastes like a tax increase of any sort, you are in big trouble. And this actually, I believe, got given a name today, this fear of raising taxes that is, you know, with good basis in the Republican Party. I think he called it Groverism. It was David Brooks. Sorry, I need to set that up better. It was David Brooks today at AEI. There was a big debate how much government is good government between Congressman Paul Ryan and David Brooks. And he was talking about how, you know, if the Deficit Commission came to, you know, if Democrats came to Republicans with a deficit reduction plan that was 80% spending cuts, 20% tax increases, that Republicans should take that deal, but that they wouldn't. And that even if it was 99% spending cuts and 1% tax increases, that they still wouldn't take the deal. So that was a point of contention between Brooks and Ryan, a sort of interesting debate on the right. You know, to what extent should Republicans compromise on something that creates fiscal health in the long run, even if it does increase taxes? You know, to what extent is it politically a big deal is a separate question.
You know, whereas on the left, a lot of the focus is on the cuts in Social Security benefits that even the commissioners themselves say is not about deficit reduction. It's a separate issue. My colleague at ourfuture.org, Richard Eskow, had a whole litany of concerns, titled 10 Reasons the Deficit Commission Proposal is Still Unconscionable and Unacceptable, noting that they tried to address this issue with the retirement age. Paul Krugman and others had noted, yes, life expectancy is going up, but not for everybody, not for folks who work at the more backbreaking blue-collar jobs. And so the commissioners tried to tweak their retirement age increase by saying that we'll create some sort of hardship exemption. And my colleague Richard Eskow said, that's a nice thought, given all the benefit slashing going on, but that decision is kicked down the road and assigned to the Social Security Administration staff. The cuts are fixed, but the exemptions are left vague and deferred to people who aren't trained in that kind of analysis. Mm-hmm. The deficit of hardship is narrow, too, and excludes hardships like discrimination. The net effect of this proposal is to ensure a longer work life for most people while making jobs harder to get. And that's a reference back to his earlier point that this proposal ignores upfront stimulus while the economy is still shaky. My group, Campaign for America's Future, put together a Citizens Commission alternative proposal that waits to do any kind of deficit reduction until the economy is on firmer footing and the unemployment rate's at a reasonable level. So it's not on at a fixed year, whereas this commission is at on a fixed year. So that's just, some of the areas where liberals are deeply concerned. Pat Garofalo at the Wonk Room notes debt commission members propose preventing Social Security benefit cuts by cutting Social Security benefits. The main claim here is when the trust fund is scheduled to be depleted, it doesn't make the entire system bankrupt. You still have incoming tax revenue, but you hit a point in 2037 where you couldn't pay out the full plan benefit. So instead of 100% of your expected benefit, you get 75%. Effectively, you get a benefit cut. And so what the commission is saying is, to avoid that, let's just cut your benefits right now. And so Pat Garofalo was sort of calling on that hypocrisy. And you have Mike Lux at Open Left pointing out, so since this proposal won't get fast-tracked to Congress, I believe at this point that enough people have openly said they'd vote no that they cannot get 14 votes. It still puts the ball at Obama's court. What does he do about what they have done? Does he embrace the entire thing? Does he embrace pieces of it? Does he say, hey, you totally missed the mark, I'm going to do something else, or not deal with it at all right now and deal with other issues? And so Mike Lux, put those choices out there then, saying, excuse me while I catch the quote. If he embraces the entire plan, he's saying it would be a terrible political decision, taking away the fervent defense of Social Security and Medicare, Democrats' strongest political selling point right now, that would make Obama's reelection hopes very dark. The second option is the more muddled option. Praise the commission for their great work. Say how glad it is that they are raising these issues. But issue a vague statement saying he doesn't agree with everything. The muddled option is a whole lot better than the first one, but the muddled option will leave nobody happy. The final option is to thank the commissioners for their work, but to clearly state what things he disagrees with, the things that target the middle class and vulnerable older Americans. Such a reaction would have the D.C. punditry scowling, but it would be such big news it would get a lot of attention. I think hard-pressed middle-class working families and senior citizens, the two big groups that turned against Obama in the last election, react very favorably to Obama standing up for him. So that is some of the there's a certain strand of commentary in the liberal blogosphere trying to convince Obama that, there's sort of a debate, is Obama on our side or not? And I think some folks have been directly accusing him of being, actively hostile toward Social Security at this point. Whereas the Mike Lux post shows a more of a constructive criticism approach. Hey, I really don't want you to do this. I don't think you have to do this. Here's an argument why you shouldn't and what you could do instead.
Well, there's a great post that Jennifer Rubin has up at her new blog at Washington Post, where she lays out a scenario that she thinks is likely, where she says, if you're a wagering person, here's a relatively safe bet. The commission won't come close to 14 votes. To be honest, that was never in the cards. and Obama will continue to demonstrate an utter lack of leadership, but Republicans will create a budget proposal combining elements of the Fiscal Commission plan, the equally dramatic Ryan Rivlin plan for entitlement reform, and a plan to repeal Obamacare. That budget will pass the House, go to the Senate, where a handful of Senate Democrats perhaps will join the Republicans, while the left wing of the Democratic caucus filibusters. Republicans will chortle at the newfound fondness for Senate procedure, but that formula then sets the stage for 2012. Do you think there's any chance that that there are a handful of Senate Democrats that would go along with some kind of concoction of deficit reduction plan, a Ryan Rivlin entitlement reform bill, and then something weakening Obamacare? I don't see how any Senate Democrats would really get on board with that, but maybe it would be something that they would do because they're coming up for re-election in 2012. Maybe somebody like a Claire McCaskill. I don't know. I would be interested in your thoughts on what senators
might
buy into something like that.
I mean, this to me is the high wire act of the year, the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. Obama clearly, I mean, not quite at the level of health care. I mean, when the health care bill got really hot, it got to the point where the entire Democratic Party, the Obama presidency, was out on a limb. You did this or your presidency was a failure. And mm-hmm. that put a huge pressure on Congress to get something done, and which at the end worked. They did get something done. Obama has been ramping up the deficit reduction rhetoric as of late. It's I don't know if it's quite at the point where he has no choice but to embrace something. But it could well get there, and he may want it to get there. But we don't totally know. And I think this is going back to Mike Lux's point. How the president reacts to this, does he set a bar that requires everybody else to put numbers to their rhetoric, mm-hmm. to have actual specifics? That potentially changes the game greatly, because as we've seen with Simpson-Bowles, you know, it's very easy to someone to tell a pollster, yes, we should cut the deficit. Once you start getting into specific proposals,
it gets much, much, much more difficult.
Right. There's just a litany of landmines out there: Social Security, Medicare, government services, upfront stimulus. You name it. You know, mm-hmm. Military spending. There's so many ways to get tripped up in this whole issue, and to do it all in one fell swoop, you know, has its pluses and minuses. So, I mean, on one hand, by doing it all together, you lend an air of seriousness to what you're doing, that you're not doing it overly mm-hmm. piecemeal, but you run the risk of having to fight multiple battles at once. So does Obama, try to raise the stakes and say, okay, Republicans, I dare you to match me on specifics here? Or does he say, look, the way the whole Simpson-Bowles thing went down did not look so hot to me?
I think that neither side – I think both sides recognize something needs to be done, and I think neither side wants to be the one unilaterally cutting spending somewhere. So I think that
Raising taxes for that matter.
Taxes. Nobody wants to be – no party wants to be in control of all three branches of – all the or not all three branches of government, both houses of Congress and the White House, and then to bring along some sort of massive tax increase. You know, nobody wants to be solely responsible, whereas if both parties are somehow can be held responsible, you can get this tougher stuff through.
What's the whole idea of having a commission of this sort in the first place, to get everyone to hold hands together and jump off the cliff in unison? But that
instead,
clearly,
just everybody decided that nobody liked it.
Right. They clearly can't get enough people behind this. I mean, they're going to get to even the bare majority with the help of unelected officials,
yeah.
not with actual elected officials. So they couldn't get actual Democrats or Republicans in office to truly, hold hands together. So do you then take the risk of having your own plan? Does Obama have his plan? Does Paul Ryan prod the House into having his plan? You're already seeing on the House side they can't get together on how to pass a healthcare repeal legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Boehner wants it to have repeal and replace, and the Tea Party folks are saying, I just want repeal. So we don't even know if they can get their act together on that one front, let alone everything else in this whole
rhetoric is easy and governing is hard. There's actually a piece I saw, not from someone on the right. It's from Sherry and Alan Rivlin, son of Alice Rivlin. They have centered politics, and they were writing that they've seen a lot of Republicans recently have come out and said, we need to have an adult conversation about deficit reduction. We need to have an adult conversation conversation, and then I think there was actually a montage on The Daily Show of people talking about the need to be adults, have an adult conversation, which they interpreted that as a sign that maybe Republicans with the rhetoric of saying we need an adult conversation, would then be able to move forward on something the Democrats might like better in terms of, you know, not extending the full tax cuts or even allowing some tax increases as a part of a deficit reduction plan. I don't know that that's what that means. I think an adult conversation doesn't necessarily imply I'm okay with increasing taxes, but that was what I read it. That was an interesting take.
Well, I mean, there's definitely a lot of, you know, adult conversation rhetoric.
Yes.
Happening right now. I mean, everyone wants to pretend that they have, a monopoly on wisdom and seriousness.
Yes.
But there's certainly a lot of critiques on the left that the Simpsons Bowl folks are not being serious. Kevin Drum, who's not even, you know, the biggest fire breather liberal out there, had a post earlier saying, look, you look at the budget projections from CBO, this is almost entirely a healthcare problem. Any serious deficit reduction proposal is 98% healthcare. And Simpson-Bowles barely touches it. So this is not a serious proposal, no matter how adult they are trying to sound in going at it. And there's certainly plenty of folks on the left on the Social Security debate saying if you're saying Social Security is headed into bankruptcy, that in of itself is unserious because that's factually not true. And you have a number of bloggers like Digby who are very angry with Obama that he's even rhetorically elevated this issue to this degree. She said she was making a point, actually, after the first Simpson-Bowles draft proposal came out, that there was such an organized response on the left that it made politicians on the Democratic side have to gut check and say, okay, if we actually did this, we really risk not a minimal split in the base, but a really deep fracture that could be very politically damaging. Saying there are many progressive initiatives and liberal interest groups that could be spending their time and money working on rather than defending the social safety net from people who would destroy it. It's a sad comment indeed that it was necessary to mobilize like this under a Democratic president congressional majority. So there is this. In certain corners, there's this deep disappointment in Obama that he has raised it to this level, and according to the argument is that it's not a serious conversation to be having to lump Social Security in with all these other issues when it's predominantly a healthcare issue, and that's been a constant pounding on the media because the media has always conflated those two things.
Well, on the right, there's also, in terms of healthcare, there's a belief that the Simpson-Bowles proposal is sort of also an acceptance that the health care reform bill is here to stay. Peter Suderman at Reason did a quick post where he linked to a Politico article that said, Representatives Paul Ryan and Jeb Hensarling said the plans called for too much in tax increases, the one big issue. Then the other, they claimed that Bowles-Simpson approach to health care would have the effect of furthering the Obama health care reform, which Republicans have vowed to repeal. That in a sense, by voting for if the plan comes, if it makes it to the floor of Congress in its current form, that a lot of Republicans would be averse to it, not just because of tax increases, but because it's almost this sort of tacit okay on the health care bill, which I don't think we'll get any Republicans to give any kind of okay to. So that's the other sticking point.
Actually, this is a post I want to write myself. It might be up by the time our show gets published. But Paul Ryan said his main reason for voting no, he's on the commission. He'll be the House Budget Chairman. He's now on the Deficit Commission. He's voting no specifically because they didn't, throw out Obamacare. He at least acknowledged a part that I agree with him, that you can't do this without dealing with health care. That's true. But Ryan and others summarily ignore the Congressional Budget Office projection that this will save $1 trillion over two decades. Now, you could obviously argue with anyone's methodology and assumptions, because it's all estimation. No one knows exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, and there were estimates that unemployment levels would be going down, that we'd be bringing. Anyway, I mean, yeah, right. there are plenty of ways you can say that the CBO did not. They don't have the dynamic scoring. It's not. Anyways.
But I think at least that you have to. I mean, Ryan acknowledges that deficit reduction, healthcare reform are linked.
Yes. Well, that's why he focuses so strongly on Medicare as his big, you know, this fix this now.
Well, right. Well, I mean, he really wants to gut Medicare. I mean, let's be serious here. He wants to turn to a private voucher program that would completely transform what Medicare has always been. Now, you could obviously conservatives have always liked that sort of plan, but
well, he's found a partner in Alice Rivlin, and oddly enough, despite the debate, David Brooks said that he took the he made a joke that he was going to take the Ryan Rivlin plan and post it on his wall like a pinup girl. It's kind of an awkward moment. And then he said it was sort of like how people would put up pictures of Farrah Fawcett. And then Paul Ryan said, "Who's Farrah Fawcett?" And it was this kind of like uncomfortable icebreaker moment.
Well, I mean, if you believe that, you believe that. I can't. Not going to make you change your mind, of course, but the reality is the Affordable Care Act is the law. This is the agreed-upon strategy to find savings in the healthcare system and put us on a path of deficit reduction. And that's not going to change, barring a completely unexpected, you know, Supreme Court decision. So, you know, if that plan is wrong, you know, we'll find out once they start implementing it. It's a gradual implementation process right now. It seems crazy to me that after you've had the debate, one side won, legislatively speaking, and you'll see how well it works, and you make adjustments as you go along. I mean, that's the only way you can reform anything in this world, is you try something out. So, I mean, and this has a whole host of experimental cost controls in it. As Krugman argued previously, some of these things are going to pan out and some of them are not. And then you learn as you go.
There's just a lot of pressure from the right on folks like Boehner to say, prove to us you're one of us, repeal it.
Oh,
don't mess around. Don't halfway do it. Do it all the way and do it first.
Oh, I get that. The House is going to have to pass something along those lines, but we all know it's not going to get signed by the president.
Right. But the argument is just... There's also this argument that by picking what you do first is sort of important symbolically. And so while you have independents in sort of post-election surveys that the Winston Group did and that other folks have done that showed that independents, they think the first priority ought to be something job-creating. I mean, you could consider an extension of the tax cuts to be something job-creating, economic-related, that the first thing really needs to be something called a job creation bill, whatever's in it, rather than the repeal and replace, whereas if you ask conservative Republicans and Tea Party, or conservative Republicans, that the first thing ought to be repeal and replace. And so, you know, it may seem like just a symbolic, you know, choice of what goes where in the agenda, but it's a big deal, particularly to conservatives, that repeal and replace be right up there.
I want to get us back to blogging, but just for my own curiosity, I've yet to see a Republican job creation plan since Election Day, not to mention before Election Day. If they were to lead with job creation first, what would be in it? Do we know?
Well, I mean, not being on the Hill and working in one of the policy shops, I don't know for sure what would be in it. I assume some manner of tax cuts, unsurprisingly. You know, under the idea that by, you know, tax cuts focus specifically at small businesses. So one of the things I've always been astonished about is in all this discussion about the extending or not extending the 2001-2003 tax cuts, the Republican point that I think is the most compelling is that, you know, you've got these small business owners that are technically considered wealthy individuals, even though it's their business's income. They're filing as an S-corp and the income passes through. That if we wanted to come up with a compromise, you know, not necessarily the Schumer, McCaskill, Menendez compromise, where they're talking about doing it at $1 million instead of $250,000, but instead, you know, do something where you take folks who are filing as part of an S corp with a pass through, and you exempt that, or you know, you allow them to maintain the tax cuts. This seems like common sense to me, but I haven't thus far heard any major policy folks bring it up. Yeah, I think if Democrats were to do that, you take away a really big and I think compelling Republican argument against, you know, keeping the tax cuts in place for everyone.
Speaking of co-opting Republican ideas, the liberal blogosphere was, I guess, pretty brutal on Obama's decision to propose a 2-year freeze on federal employee salaries. Mm-hmm. You had Jamelle Bouie at the American Prospect, who has guested for me on this fine program before. And I wouldn't say, I mean, here's someone who's actually took some flack from other liberal bloggers for being critical of Marcos's American Taliban book, so maybe a little bit more left of center than, hard left, but said the federal pay freeze is bizarre, self-defeating, and pointless. It's worth pointing out just how underpaid federal workers are compared to their private sector counterparts, especially after President Obama's decision to adopt and reinforce the conservative idea that government workers are way overpaid. This whole notion that he is embracing a conservative frame. Tim Fernholz, his colleague at the American Prospect, mockingly saying how there's no way that independent voters are going to give Obama credit for taking this sort of tack. Quote, don't worry, I'm sure the media independent voters will give the president credit for his moderate position, just like they did for his deficit-cutting centrist health care plan based on the ideas of Mitt Romney, and has offered a compromise on Bush tax policy by extending the tax cuts for the entire population rather than disproportionately benefiting the wealthy, right? So there's this decision in particular really kind of crystallized a narrative in the liberal blogosphere that Obama is a terrible negotiator. David Kurtz at Talking Points Memo criticized negotiating against yourself. Government goes first usually means Democrats go first in these negotiations. Republicans then use that concession to refine the middle as further to the right, at which point Democrats concede again, the whole cycle repeats itself. And Ezra Klein had a whole post talking about Obama's bad poker. So I guess I can't find a single blog post out there. I mean, usually there's a certain degree of difference of opinion out there. I mean, I even found more moderate type bloggers criticizing Obama just on the politics of it, saying that it just wasn't going to get him anywhere.
I would say I don't think it really did get him anywhere. I mean, if the idea was to try to gain some sort of, again, like with the deficit commission, to try to gain some sort of ground in terms of pretending like he's a fiscal conservative of some kind, that this was, I don't want to say it got a collective eye roll, but sort of, and the big problem when it comes to, government employees is a lot of, state and local pensions. That's the big issue that is driving things. And yes, it's the idea that someone in the federal government with a certain level of education, controlled for all of that, is earning more than someone in the private sector. Freezing wages for 2 years just I don't think has been seen in the blogosphere as big a deal. And I think it was Raihan Salam at NRO's The Agenda that pointed out, it's really it's more the pensions that are the big issues rather than this pay freeze, which is kind of small potatoes.
And this whole notion about negotiation, bleeds into the whole tax cut discussion. You have now both MoveOn.org and Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which has generally positioned itself more aggressively on the left than MoveOn has. MoveOn has been a little bit more nuanced in its approach to Obama, and PCCC has generally played more of a smash mouth approach. Both of them have TV ads that they're pushing, challenging Obama's fortitude on the tax cut issue because mm-hmm. he has not ruled out a compromise that involves a temporary extension of the tax cuts for the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest. He's ruled out a permanent extension for them. No one knows where this debate's going to go because Republicans have not made any kind of indication at a concession along the same lines. So
this may be remembering ancient history in political terms, but I believe there was a brief moment when John Boehner was on TV
yes.
and said that he would consider making that compromise. And I was sort of surprised it never came back up again.
Well, it was a matter of fact, the PCCC ad takes Obama's comments from the campaign trail, where he's very, very definitive because he's on the campaign trail, and combines that with that Boehner clip. Mm-hmm. That's basically that one instance where the facade on the right cracked a bit to say, if you stand strong, they will crack. Now, I think you could argue that that's a highly oversimplified notion of what's going to happen.
Now you have the 42 senators, Republican senators. You got, you know, Olympia Snow on board writing this letter saying nothing happens until you take action on these critical items. So I would not underestimate the will, the strength or the will of a group of Republicans that just overwhelmingly won a bunch of elections.
No, I mean, it would seem that. I mean, what we don't know, I think the House is going to vote on a middle-class tax cut bill, extending it for the middle class only and not the wealthy.
Yeah, cause it's going to be I read today that they found like an end around the rules where they're going to append it to a bill about airports so that it doesn't have to deal with the motion to recommit. Like there's it basically takes Republicans' ability to stop it away. I think Boehner called it chicken something. There we go. Yes.
Sorry, minor technical hiccup there, but to pick up where you left off, Kristen, you were talking about Rehan Salon's suggestions on how to approach this tax cut compromise.
Well, he and Josh Barrow suggest extending all of the tax cuts for 2 to 3 years, just temporarily, that's a better option than something that was proposed. It's this Schumer-McCaskill-Menendez option, which wants to take the limit for where they, you know, where the tax cut off would happen, instead of doing it at $250,000, doing it at $1 million, and they go through the reasons why, you know, the New York and New Jersey senators would want to do that because they have a number of high earners in their state. McCaskill is, you know, trying to look more conservative because she's up for re-election. They say that by raising it that much, that's really sort of unwise to do as compared to just keeping them all for 2 to 3 years. What I'm most surprised by is I kind of can't believe that Democrats let this go until the lame duck, or rather that they let so many things go until the lame duck session, sort of under the assumption that with the elections off the table, that all of this more controversial legislation would have more life to it. And there's an interesting piece by William Vogeli of a commentary where he said, the New York Times editorialized that the Obama plan, by cornering the GOP on tax cuts and tax cuts for the wealthy, was smart politics on behalf of good policy. Holding the middle class tax cuts hostage for those for the wealthy would pose both a political danger to Republicans and an economic danger to the nation. And then a funny thing happened. Nothing. First the Democratic House and then the Democratic Senate decided to adjourn without holding a vote on Obama's tax proposal. They wanted to go home and campaign. But a decisive contingent of vulnerable incumbents refused to campaign on that. Democrats postponed consideration of the issue to the relative safety of a post-election lame duck session. Basically, kind of calling Democrats out for saying this. If this is such a political winner for you, if Republicans are so evil for wanting to keep these tax cuts for the rich, then why didn't you do it before the election? Why'd you wait until the lame duck to force this issue?
Well, what I think happened there, and I think the one wrong part of your premise is that it was some sort of jointly collective decision. This was the best thing to do. This would be the best way to get it done.
What? I will concede I do not think that there is some vast left-wing conspiracy masterminded by one person, because bless your heart, if there's one thing that Democrats are not good at, it is sort of all getting on the same page.
Well, I think so many things come down to, you know, as far as why don't Democrats do this or Democrats do that. Democrats are a divided party. They are a big tent party. They have ideological divisions beyond just the basic progressive versus blue dog that make it very difficult for them to act in a coordinated fashion. And part of that is that it takes a long time to get big things done, like healthcare reform and Wall Street reform, and that ends up crowding your legislative calendar. But the other part is that, and I'm extrapolating this or interpreting this from a line in a recent New York Times story that buried at the end that two of the senators that pressed Reid to not hold this vote on the tax cuts before the election were not right-leaning Democrats. My head was always scratching at the time because the right-leaning folks weren't the ones who were up for re-election on the Senate side for the most part. So what do they care when the vote is done? Apparently it was Senators Boxer and Murray who impressed upon Reid that it would not be helpful to them to have that vote before the election. So here are generally liberal senators in generally liberal states, but with some wealthy constituencies that would not be as appreciative of that vote. So I think that's where it comes down to. I mean, I think there were a lot of other senators or congressmen saying, hey, it would be very useful for me to have this vote. I'd like to have the clear contrast. I like to put my opponent on the defensive. But certain folks balked, and that made it impossible to have a joint decision. Although I can't subscribe at all to that, because apparently senators on the Democratic side still can't decide what to do. And this goes beyond the electoral considerations and comes back to the fact that you just have ideological divisions in the party. So that makes it very hard for, I mean, people say, why doesn't Obama come out there and, you know, draw this line or draw that line? I mean, he can't easily draw a line unilaterally if the rest of his party is not going to go along.
Well, and setting aside the idea of, I don't want to say class warfare, but the idea of, you know, should the government be spending and, you know, soaking the rich to get it? I mean, setting all that aside, there's also the question of what, you know, to what extent would allowing the tax cuts to expire on wealthy Americans really do a whole lot? And you have Nick Gillespie at Reason, who kind of had what I thought was a funny post the other day, where he says it's a simple, plain, and nearly universally unacknowledged fact that the feds haven't been able to raise revenue for much past the 19% of GDP bar for any period of time since World War II. It doesn't matter what the top marginal rate is, or the bottom, or nothing. The government is going to pull in just under 19% maximum. Some years it might be a little higher, some years it might be a little lower, but it ain't budging over the long haul, defined as the last 60 or so years. That is the limit of what we can spend if we want to have a balanced budget. Obama's own budget projections have the Fed spending more than 22% of GDP each year over the next decade. You do the math. What the government can do is change how much, gosh darn, money it shells out. So that's his big focus, is saying this is not, if you're really serious about deficit reduction, you can't spend 3% more of GDP than you bring in, and raising taxes on the rich isn't actually going to create that much more money that you're bringing in, so why bother?
I don't know if I fully accept the premise that there is this sort of magical ceiling that you can never get more revenue.
I don't know. The graph is rather compelling, because it shows I should have printed it out. I can hold it up. But it's kind of bizarre. I mean, it goes back and it shows the top marginal tax rate. I mean, you know, up at like the 80-90% that it's been at in the past, and shows it coming down, you know, shows it go up, shows it coming down. And it's the little line of how much revenue is as a percentage of GDP, just it stays really flat despite what the marginal tax rate line does.
I thought it was a little distorted, though, because the difference between a percentage point of a tax rate is not the same as the difference between a percentage point of GDP.
Yes.
So the way that tax rate line goes up and down, the GDP line stays relatively flat, I think makes it seem more contrasting than it actually is.
Fair enough.
I mean, just as a mathematical point, I mean, if you could raise...
GDP is growing, and I see what you're saying, but I think that his post was reflective of what I believe is a valid point, that it is not wise to spend great, or at least conservatives don't believe it's wise to spend a lot and to anticipate that just tweaking the taxes on rich Americans is a way for us to say, hey, thanks for making so much money, we're going to take that now and have the government spend it on other things. That's not going to create the sort of economic growth we need, and that it's not necessarily a good policy for government to allow itself to spend 22% of GDP every year.
I mean, if memory serves, I might have my numbers a little bit off. If you ended the tax cuts for the wealthy, I think people will say that's going to coop you, I think they say $400 billion. I can't remember if it's $400 or $700 billion. I think $400 billion.
Let's see. The Ryan Salam piece. Hold on. If I'm reading this right, it says $4 trillion. But
no, but that's the entire tax cut package.
That's the whole thing.
That's the whole thing.
That's
middle class and wealthy.
But that.
I think the wealthy part, I think it's $400 billion, but it's either 4 or 7. For some reason, I got two numbers in my head. But
yeah,
but
it's 400 billion, because yeah, it is. I'm now looking at the graph here properly.
Now,
it's 400 billion.
Now both 400 billion and 4 trillion, you seem like these ginormous numbers, but these are both those things are over 10-year windows. To end the tax, yeah, I believe we should end the tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, I think that it's a basic question of. I think they can afford to do it, and it would be a help towards long-term fiscal stability. But that alone doesn't solve, you know, these long-term fiscal issues, because on a year-to-year basis, you're talking $40 billion a year, not $400 billion. And these are the same thing. I mean, I want to be consistent about this. You had conservatives that were attacking, you know, the health care bill, saying this $1 trillion health care bill. Well, that was also over a 10-year period. And also ignored all the cost savings that happened at the same time. So it's very
What I will point out is, recall, this was the Paul Ryan point from the meeting at the White House, was that you're talking about this is how much it will cost over 10 years, and this is how much we will save, but the expenses didn't really go into effect for, you know, quite a few years. So it was sort of, I don't want to say fuzzy math, but it was an improper balance between this is how much it will cost over 10 years, but the expenditures weren't really supposed to start for a little ways into it.
Well, the bigger savings for healthcare, according to CBO, is in the second decade. Just the way that healthcare reforms, you know, phase in and how you get an accumulative effect, that's just the way it was going to be. I don't think that was some sort of budget trickery. It's just the nature of the beast. But the point is, it's very easy to get back to the tax cut issue. It's very easy to make 10-year numbers seem much bigger than they are. So I grant the conservative point that as far as budgetary matters are concerned, these taxes for the wealthy are not, you know, the end-all be-all of everything. I'm hard-pressed, and this is an ideological disagreement, of course, that somehow if the wealthy kept that money, they would do some magical things with it that would create jobs, when we just tried that strategy out in the Bush years, and that didn't work. So I would still argue they can't afford it. It would help in some small way towards the budget deficit, and so why not? But those arguments are somewhat, you know, neither here nor there, because most Democrats agree with what I'm saying. All Republicans don't, and you got a handful of Democrats kind of in this mushy middle, and they have a clock to figure out a common ground, or they all go up, taxes on the wealthy, tax on the middle class, estate taxes and everything. And as far as getting back to the blogosphere critique is concerned, the left is concerned that Obama doesn't have a good game plan to avoid a weak compromise here, and the right seems to be saying, you know, digging your heels as much as possible. I assume to have a gridlock, so they can push a permanent expansion, permanent extension in January.
In one sense, I will agree that Republicans believe that they ought to be very firm and that they sort of have earned the right to be firm. But on the other hand, you have a lot of folks, particularly folks who have been around longer, who sort of still have these like nightmarish flashbacks to the outcome of the government shutdown and would like to avoid that again. Did not work out so well for us last time. So, I don't know that in the game of brinksmanship we are actually going to see full stoppage of everything. And to go sort of to a new topic, you saw a little bit of wiggle room today with some folks saying that this, you know, the 42 senators saying we won't take up anything until we've passed what we need to pass, have started to say that the START treaty is something that they would see as an exception, that that's not considered a legislative item, and so they would be willing to deal with that.
Now, this is a week after John Kyle said, this is dead. START is dead. I want you to modernize nuclear arsenal. You did some things to try to make me happy, and I still don't like them. And I decree that this will not pass in the lame duck session. And now all of a sudden, you're seeing Republican senators start to have more nuanced takes on what might happen to START. Are conservative bloggers have any accounting for why Republican senators are buckling a little bit here?
You've recently had all of these former Republican secretaries, or not that they are formerly Republican, although I think in some cases maybe, former secretaries of state for Republican presidents who have come out with a piece saying, you know, here's why you need to do it, here are the things that you're concerned about, we promise this isn't that big a deal. To my knowledge, the biggest hang-up is over missile defense. There's some language in the preamble of the treaty recognizing the existence of the interrelationship between strategic offensive arms and strategic defensive arms, that this interrelationship will become more important as strategic nuclear arms are reduced, and that the current strategic defensive arms do not undermine the viability and effectiveness of the strategic offensive arms of the parties, et cetera, et cetera. Basically saying you're not allowed to create the sort of missile defense that, or that reduction in offense also means you can't up your defense so that your opponent's weapons are useless. And that there's concern, you know, the Obama administration and Russia is saying, oh, no, no, that doesn't mean we can't build missile defense systems or we can't do extra things. Whereas Republicans are saying, I'm just reading the language, and that looks an awful lot like it's saying we can't build missile defense systems or we can't increase our amount of missile defense. And right now, that's more important when you've got North Korea that's going off the deep end. We need something that can take care of these missiles. If this treaty in any way prevents us from building more robust missile defense, I'm not on board. So I don't know if there's just been greater acceptance within Republican Senate minds that maybe that language issue is not as big a deal and that they're coming to accept the Obama administration's assurances that it's not that big a deal. I mean, there's still a big debate. You have, you know, bloggers at Red State that say, you know, bloggers at Red State that believe that START 2 is a horrible idea. You have another sort of interesting I think the other factor that is pushing some Republicans, for instance, John McCain, to move a little bit closer toward supporting START, this from Ala Pundit at Hot Air, who's been who has a post up about this, that NATO began installing missile defense batteries in Eastern European countries in the spring, and Russia responded by moving tactical nukes toward the border. START doesn't deal with either of those subjects. It's limited to strategic nukes. But until the issue of strategic nukes is nailed down, there will be no discussion of tactical nukes. Under those circumstances, I'm amazed that a hawk like Maverick would respond by softening on START instead of demanding that the warheads be withdrawn as a precondition to ratification. But the idea is that now, you know, on Tuesday you had this report come out that Russia has moved some tactical nukes near some of our NATO allies. Some folks say you should respond to that by saying, we're not even talking START until you get those out of there. Other folks are saying, and apparently John McCain is moving, to say, we can't even begin talking to Russia about what to do about their tactical nukes until we've signed something about the strategic nukes. So I don't know to what extent that's impacting a lot of folks beyond McCain, or if that's even necessarily McCain's rationale. I think this is speculation, but it makes sense.
I mean, you have this big op-ed earlier this week from five former Republican secretaries of state calling for the approval of the treaty, saying it's a modest and appropriate continuation of the previous START treaty, reduces the number of nuclear weapons each side deploys, while enabling the United States to maintain a strong nuclear deterrent and preserving the flexibility to deploy those forces as we see fit. Kevin Drum said, how can this possibly be a difficult vote for Republican senators? It should be a no-brainer. And then as a side point, he says, what happened to Condoleezza Rice? Every other Republican Secretary of State is onto this op-ed. Why isn't she?
I think she did come out and say that she supported it. I saw this as like a link somewhere, but when I clicked on it, it tried to take me to a paywall, so I couldn't see the full post.
I guess my question is...
And this is like right before the show, so I couldn't research it further.
And so there definitely seems to be a split within the Republican, you know, elected officials and Republican elder statesmen on this issue. Is that split reflected in the conservative blogosphere, or is all conservative bloggers saying no START, no START, no START?
Most bloggers I'm seeing are saying no START. They're more in line with this. George Will had a column where he said, you know, at Russia's insistence, the treaty contains language that some Republicans think does, and the Obama administration insists does not, couple limits on offensive and defensive systems. If it does, Republicans should oppose the treaty, and if the language is, as the administration says, without force, then it should be deleted. So I think that generally the thought is that this is the biggest problem. If, as the Obama administration says, this language is meaningless, then just take it out. If you take it out, then you've taken out our big reason to complain about it. So, by and large, this sort of all began with, the first time that I really saw somebody come out and start, you know, writing something about this, it was a Mitt Romney op-ed back during the summer about why this new START treaty was America giving up too much. And most of the arguments you're seeing in the conservative blogosphere are sort of echoing that it's America giving up stuff to a country that wants to pretend it's a superpower, but it's not. This is sort of indulging. There was an interesting line about how and I believe this was from the Red State Post, that the article by the five Republican secretaries of state was basically a lot of old Cold War folks indulging the glory days and thinking to them and still being stuck in a Cold War mindset where reducing the number of nuclear missiles that, you know, Russia has, that's important, whereas what's most important is our ability to defend against missiles and, you know, from rogue countries. And so that's why the treaty is unsuited to modern.
Well, beyond sort of the technical parts of the treaty, there's this larger geopolitical argument, which is we need to have good relations with Russia if we're going to have a strong, unified front against Iran to get mm-hmm. them to back down the on their nuclear program and avoid having a larger confrontation. I mean, it certainly seems that you have a number of Republicans who are embracing that notion, older school Republicans who are joining Obama on this. I can't see if you are more if you're deeply concerned about Iran and not just wanting to have a war for war's sake, wouldn't you, even if you had some hesitation about some aspects of the treaty, wouldn't you want to say, okay, I think Iran is our biggest foreign policy problem right now. Let's do everything we can to try to prevent that from spiraling out of control. Let's see how this treaty helps and see how Russia acts after that's done. They've made some motions against Iran because of this diplomatic reset. I would understand what would be the logic in trying to derail that.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily being done to derail that. I think that there's a real fear that this treaty is going to tie our hands in ways that that currently the administration thinks it won't, and that, if we create a situation where we can't adequately defend ourselves, then we've locked ourselves into a treaty needlessly, whereas if we do some tweaks to the language, that would be much more palatable. Now, the question, too, is how is Russia going to react if Obama has to go back to them and say, by the way, we'd like to make these few little changes, that it sounds like Russia would not be terribly pleased with that, leaving the Obama administration sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. But I think that at the end of the day, it's the missile defense point being made by Republicans is incredibly valid and something that the George Will column points out could be easily taken care of if the language, what we're basically arguing over is what does a sentence mean? So if it's a sentence that is supposed to be meaningless, just take it out. Just take it out, and you've taken one of the biggest arguments away, and you can move forward to dealing with Iran, which, given what we've seen from WikiLeaks, this is certainly something that we have. There's a little more agitation out there in other countries than we had, than perhaps the public had generally thought.
I mean, a lot of times with treaty language, and I'm not an expert on the START Treaty. I'm not one to take George Will at face value, so I don't want to presume everything that he's saying is true. But as a general matter, you often have certain points of ambiguous language in international treaties and documents, so both sides can walk away and interpret it as they wish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often how the wheels of governance turn. You both of you want to do something. You got a sticking point over here. Let's try to gloss over that with some vague language and move on with ourselves. So while you could sort of blithely say, "Hey, just take that line out, it'd be no biggie," if it was no biggie, it would be no biggie. So
well, but the whole issue is that the idea of missile defense is really based in this Cold War mentality where if I've got 1,000 missiles and you've got 1,000 missiles, if I create the capability to defend against 1,000 missiles, then you've got to create 2,000. And you don't want to have to create 2,000. So you and I come up with a treaty where we say we won't create missile defense systems so that we don't get caught in some kind of really expensive arms race. Basically, we're acknowledging that we each have the ability to destroy each other. We promise we won't take that away so that deterrence doesn't go away. We don't live in that kind of, we still, other countries do have tons of nuclear weapons, but it's not that same kind of, deterrence world so much as it is we need to be able to prevent a rogue state from launching. So that's why I believe that language sounds like an artifact from an older time. And so if Russia, I don't know, I can see why Russia would probably want to keep it in since they're at the disadvantage here in terms of number of nuclear missiles, but it strikes me as something that is antiquated, and I think it's a legitimate concern that Republicans have to say we don't want to get caught with any sort of restriction on our ability to defend ourselves.
The other foreign policy issue of the week, perhaps one that was thought to be this huge story at the beginning of the week, and maybe it's sort of faded by the end of the week, is the WikiLeaks dump, where it was touted in the news organizations that had the leaks as something that was going to be earth-shattering for American diplomacy. And I think its impact by the end of the week is at least unclear, but certainly had a lot of blogger commentary. And I think on the left, it really ranged from these documents just show the Obama administration conducts foreign policy in a fairly professional manner, not all that interesting, to you know, WikiLeaks should be heralded for exposing the truth, and more specifically later in the week, some on the left were really focusing on this one document that Obama leaned on Spain not to pursue a legal case against some of the Bush administration folks who were allegedly sanctioning torture. So you had over at Foreign Policy Passport blog, David Kenner, headline is WikiLeaks makes the U.S. look good. These are the most sensible, boring cables that I've come across yet. Talking about a specific instance dealing with an issue with riots in France and how the White House dealt with it in a very, you know, calm and nuanced manner. Fred Kaplan at Slate also saying how, you know, in a number of instances, this just shows that the White House was simply handling things in a professional manner. But you had Digby over at Hullabaloo saying it's talking about this whole issue with Spain and the Bush torturers. You know, it's one thing not to want to look in the rearview mirror. It's quite another to veer into someone else's lane and crash their car to keep them from looking into theirs. Not that it's a shock that this happened. At the time the story was in the papers, I think most of us probably assumed there would be American pressure to shut it down. But I guess I hope that it was an unofficial rather than a secret coordinated Democratic and Republican cover-up who says bipartisanship is dead. So there's definitely, you know, a split view on what these mean and what the value of the WikiLeaks organization to pursue this stuff. Now, I take it on the right, the general attitude has been, how do we assassinate the leader of WikiLeaks?
Yeah, Julian Assange does not have a lot of friends on the American right. I mean, you'd think that, you know, leaks that had the potential to make the Obama administration look bad, you know, if Republicans really were intent on disliking Democrats, you know, this is not an enemy, the enemy is our friend sort of thing. Julian Assange is the enemy here. If you're reading on the right, you have Michelle Malkin. Her line was, the America haters would have us unilaterally disarm diplomatically under the guise of the public's right to know. This is suicide. I mean, some really strong, strong disdain for WikiLeaks. And a real dismissal of the idea that this is anything in the public interest. Back to Ala Pundit. He said, you know, the point of leaking government documents ostensibly is to expose matters of urgent public interest. Sometimes that means revealing state crimes. Sometimes it means exposing state disinformation. Sometimes it simply means that something so important is going on that citizens need to know about it, notwithstanding the value of its secrecy. That said, what's the urgent public interest in revealing this? And he posts an item about one of the cables where we basically say that we're a little concerned about what's going on in Turkey. We are not confident that things are going the way we like. And he follows up by saying, that is to say, what's the ratio among the leaked documents of those that expose urgent public matters and those that simply embarrass the American diplomatic corps and alienate their foreign counterparts? That a lot of these things, for instance, the idea that we're uncomfortable with the direction of how things are going in Turkey, that's one of those, everybody already knew that. So why are, you know, you can't claim that you've done some, like, really noble thing and told the, you know, exposed this important truth that the world was waiting for, because you haven't said a lot that we didn't already know. There was no, I think the only thing out of WikiLeaks that I've heard of that made me go, like, oh, that might be a little controversial, is the idea that Hillary Clinton encouraged diplomats to find credit card numbers and DNA and, you know, the basically turning diplomats into intelligence officials. I mean, there's a gray line there between trying to absorb information about the country that you're in and actively getting people's frequent flyer numbers. But that was the only thing that I saw that you could even really paint as, like, some massive government conspiracy right. that needed to be exposed. Right. So,
and even that's a little debatable. Mark Amender has a piece up at the National Journal titled What Hillary Clinton Didn't Do. The Secretary of State did not turn diplomats into spies. So mm-hmm. there's even some debate whether what those cables actually
yeah.
meant. Now, but to the other point, if you're going to argue that you didn't reveal anything that was really all that interesting or new, and therefore you had no national interest or a larger public interest in doing it, that doesn't logically follow that he's the enemy of the state and needs to be locked up in prison or shot. It just means that he wasted his time.
Well, I think the fact that nothing is revolutionary doesn't mean that it's not important that it's out there. You know, to kind of go to a goofy, you know, example, it's sort of like, it's one of those things where, like, you can always, you know, everybody can know that, like, in a group of friends, let's say you've got the one that everybody's sort of like, you know, so-and-so's got, like, bad, you know, some kind of bad habit, but nobody wants to, like, bring it up to that person. Everybody sort of knows it. But if all of a sudden, you know, that friend finds out, like, oh, you've been saying all this horrible stuff about me? I mean, I don't know that countries are necessarily so different from, you know, perhaps a group of teenage girls upset, like, why would you say this about me? So,
I don't dispute that. I don't think we know what kind of, you know, long-term damage it's going to have. I don't think you can assess
yeah.
that, you know, in a day or two, and no one's going to announce to the public what they're exactly mad about, or so you might not know until other issues, you know, or confrontations pop up.
Well, and you've created, I think, problems for instance, you know, in Saudi Arabia. Now, how do you, you know, what do you have to say to your people to prove that you're actually really hardline when it's come out that you are sort of supportive of, like, why haven't you guys done something about Iran yet?
Well, this was an argument. So, the counterargument to that was done by a blogger named John Western at the Duck of Minerva, post was picked up by the Progressive Realist, saying the irony here is that perhaps the top beneficiary so far has been the neocons' number one project, strengthening Israel's position on stopping the Iranian nuclear program. In the cables from the Ankara, Annan, Cairo, Riyadh, and several embassies in Europe, there is a strong and unambiguous consensus that Iran is isolated in its position. This has been reported for some time in the press, but the press reports have not always been consistent or clear. The raw language from so many foreign leaders disclosing these cables now sends an unmistakable signal to Tehran and seriously limits Iran's room for maneuvering here. It almost certainly lowers the risk of Iranian miscalculation, that they can play different regional or international actors off one another. It's clear the Saudis and other Gulf states are serious in their objections and may well acquiesce to an Israeli strike. There's no room for Tehran to leverage Turkey. Both Egypt and Turkey are aggressively working to pull Syria away from Iran. The Russians can't be counted upon. So, I mean, I'm not saying this guy is definitely right in his analysis, but it's certainly, it's unclear what the larger foreign policy impact might be. And it's not to say that Julian Assange didn't break the law or Bradley Manning didn't break the law in stealing these documents. But as far as whether it rises to the level of being an enemy of the state and therefore warranting extrajudicial measures, it would seem that the argumentation even on the right is not consistent on that front.
Well, there was actually sort of an interesting post by Michael Brendan Doherty at the American Conservative that kind of takes on neoconservatives in saying, this was his quote, the problem with an American strike on Iran isn't that it would or wouldn't be in Israel's interest. It's that it's not in the American interest. Adding King Abdullah doesn't make a hill of difference. Why should Uncle Sam muscle up on his behalf? Needless to say, I find it strange that an ideological cohort so anxious about the charge that it advocates policies primarily in the anxious about the charge that it advocates policies primarily in the interest of a foreign nation would bolster its case for war with Iran by dragging in a Saudi royal as their leading witness. So there's even contention on the right that for neocons to bolster their argument on going for Iran by pointing and saying, look, King Abdullah agrees with us, is a little bit, not necessarily contradictory, but it's a little bit odd.
Well, perhaps we'll leave it on that note.
I guess so.
But it's always great to talk to you, Kristen.
Great talking to you, too.
I hope we'll see you again soon. Tell folks again where they can find your work.
You can find it at kristensoltis.com or pollster.com, which is now huffpostpollster.com.
Very exciting. All right, well, we'll see you folks next week on This Week in Blog.